A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to You're Booked. I'm Daisy Buchanan, your host, book inspector and slow reader. I'm in my 12th week of reading Anna Karenina, and Levin is still in a field with a scythe. My brand new book, The Sisterhood, A Love Letter to the Women Who Shaped Me, is published by Headline, and it's available online and from bookshops across the UK at the moment. Now to this week's guest, the writer and broadcaster, Christina Patterson. Christina has one of the most impressive and fascinating career trajectories of anyone I know. The former director of the Poetry Society, she left the organisation to become a lead interviewer and columnist at The Independent. Christina was, among other fabulous subjects, the first person to interview Gordon Brown after he left office. However, I fell in love with her work a little later, in 2018, when I discovered her brilliant memoir, The Art of Not Falling Apart. A tender, gorgeously written, sparky and furious story about losing her job at The Independent and how she lost and found her identity afterwards. Christina has known triumph and tragedy and writes about both in a way that is deeply compassionate, shockingly honest and always funny. She is the embodiment of E.M. Forster's maxim, only connect. She's also my favourite sort of person, the kind that is absolutely addicted to books. We rummaged around her many shelves and talked about death, sex and poets making passes at Ted Hughes in taxis. So we are here in Christina's study. Now we've seen a lot of books on your book and we've seen some really vast collections, but I think you've got nearly as many books as Andy Miller.
I listened to
a lot of books. So are all these books that you have been sent to review, or are some of these books you have for fun?
Some of them are for fun. I have reviewed quite a lot of them over the years, and some in this pile I've been sent to review, but I usually, if I don't read them fairly swiftly, and I very often don't have time to read them if I'm not actually reviewing them for, I mostly review for the Sunday Times, then I probably won't keep it because, as you see, I'm a bit low on bookshelf space now.
I've just seen you've got Nick Hornby, How to Be Good.
Oh, yes.
Would you say that you are a good reader? And are you a respecter of books, or are you a spine shatterer?
No, I generally have to read a book with the pen in hand. I have to, partly because so many of the books I read, I review. But even if I'm not reviewing it, I like to remember stuff. So I generally scrawl all over books. I've probably got hundreds of first editions that would have been worth quite a lot if I hadn't wrecked them by scrawling all over them. I don't know if I've scrawled on that one. It's possible I haven't.
So this is a hardback, so I'm guessing it's a first.
Yeah. It probably is. So this is what a book looks like if I'm... And half the time I can't read my notes.
I can't read your writing, so
I can't,
all of your
I can't
secrets
read my
about
writing.
This book, we shall not name. Because you've got a really interesting relationship with books, I think, because you worked in publishing for a long time. And you know, you're a current affairs journalist and a book reviewer. When did you start reading? Were you always enthusiastic?
I've always read. And I don't think you'll meet many journalists or writers who haven't been, I'm sure, obsessive readers. So I mean, I loved Enid Blyton as a child, mad about Enid Blyton, used to dream of being sent off to boarding school and having a midnight feast in the dorm. And when on my first day at my secondary school, I was so excited about having to wear a uniform, and my best friend and I both bought the optional hat. And of course, we found we were then the only idiots in the whole school, so that was discarded after about 2 days. And that was pure Mallory Towers and Enid Blyton. So yes, I was a complete obsessive reader as a child. And I remember once sitting in, my parents converted the loft into a spare room. And I remember sitting there once reading an Iris Murdoch. I was probably a teenager, having a piece of cake and a cup of coffee or tea. And I remember actually crying because I was so happy. That hasn't changed in all these years. For me, my idea of heaven is reading an absorbing book with a piece of cake and a cup of tea or a glass of wine and a bowl of kettle chips. There is literally nothing I like doing more.
That sounds like heaven. That is the motif I loved so much in your memoir. And there's so much to love in your memoir. It's excellent. But the recurring, pretty much everything is a bit better if you've got a bowl of crisps, kettle chips for preference.
Well, it is. I just think it is. Or cake, but in particular, crisps. There is something particularly special about crisps, but we're meant to be talking about books, not crisps. Yeah. So I won't go on about them at great length.
That's another. We should pitch that podcast, though, the crisp podcast. One thing I like to ask people is, are there any books that you have strong memories of reading while knowing that possibly you shouldn't have been reading them, and there might be either a parent or librarian who would take it off your hands?
Yes. Well, in my parents' downstairs loo, there was a shelf, and on that shelf, there was a book called Lady Chatterley's Lover. And I don't remember how old I was, but I do remember picking it up and flicking through it and being utterly transfixed. And I don't think I have a copy, actually. So I haven't got St. Dorrance here. Have I got it? Do you know what? It doesn't look as though... Oh, I have got it there, but I haven't read that edition.
Yeah, there as well. I think it's Penguins too.
That's the one. That's the one I read as a child then.
Oh, wow. And that's the one that was in the bath.
That would be the one that was in the downstairs loo. And I remember the kind of incredible goose flesh when I didn't read the whole thing, obviously. I just flicked through it and then found the sea that various scenes were. And I remember there being, flowers in his pubic hair.
And
it gave me a very sort of unexpected image of sex. So
was this sort of before you were a teenager?
Yes. Or? Oh God, yes. I must have been 8 or 9 or something, and being kind of utterly electrified and sort of not sure whether to be disgusted or you know, kind of, well, you know, find pleasure in it. But certainly it felt illicit. And as we all know, there's nothing like illicit pleasure.
There's something, I think, really, really powerful, isn't there, about those early things where maybe 80% of it sort of goes over your head, but you know it's the power of allusion to something and, you know, the sort of what's being omitted. And, God, there are so many things as well where what was happening or what I was imagining was actually probably a lot wilder and weirder than what was actually being described, because I had no idea. So I thought,
yes, exactly.
I'm trying to find the part. Would you, if I can, would you read it out, or would you prefer?
I don't know if I can find it. Literally,
not falling open to that page.
No, that's weird, isn't it? Still, she thought the most beautiful part of her was the long sloping fall of the haunches from the socket of the back and the slumberous round stillness of the buttocks. Like hillocks of sand, the Arabs say, soft and downward slipping with a long slope. Here the life still lingered hoping, but here too she was thinner and going unripe, astringent. But the front of her body made her miserable. It was already beginning to slacken with a slack sort of thinness, almost withered, going old before it had ever really lived. She thought of the child she might somehow bear. Was she fit anyhow? I don't know if she was in her 30s or what when she was worrying about her body.
I mean, I sound
withering.
A bit glib, but, you know, I think about all of the way I think about my body and how it makes me, you know, grumpy and miserable, and the body confidence issues I have, and I think a lot of us have. Well, that sort of puts it in perspective, doesn't it? I think if we could see ourselves as D.H. Lawrence saw women, we might be a bit kinder.
Do you know, 27, she says, she was old, old at 27, with no gleam and sparkle in the flesh. My God, 27 probably seemed incredibly old when I was reading it. But
I was reading an old Jilly Cooper, and there's a rugged romantic hero. I think this is in Imogen. And he's unlikely because, you know, he's quite old. He's quite a bit older than the heroine. And he's, you know, could he love again because he's already had a bit of a life and he's been around. He's 32.
Mm. Oh, it's just incredible. I've just seen the book that...
Well, oh, I'm so glad that you're pointing to Barbara Trepido because I love her.
I was working in a bookshop when I'd finished my MA. I did an MA in the novel. And my father said... I'd gone back to the family home. My father said, so when are you going to get a job then? So I walked up and down Guildford High Street with my CV and came home and said, I've got a job, Dad. I'm working in Penguin Bookshop. And I think he thought, well, not really that kind of, wouldn't really mean that kind of a job. But anyway, I worked there for a few months.
Oh, so it was and, a Penguin Bookshop.
Yes, like I loved...
The publisher had a bookshop.
Yes, they did. And it was one of my favourite jobs ever, actually, because having done an MA, which was full of Barthes and Derrida and... postmodernism and all this stuff, which having done kind of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight for my English literature degree at Durham, it was a bit of a shock to be suddenly talking about privileging this over that in, you know, kind of jargon ridden prose. But I did have, you know, Malcolm Bradbury and Angela Carter and Lorna Sage. So there were some great people teaching. And it was amazing. But I remember sitting around doing my sort of reading, I don't know, ploughing through Middlemarch or Tristram Shandy, which, by the way, is one of my favourite books, and also thinking, oh, I'm feeling a bit hard done by being essentially paid by the taxpayer to sit around and read fiction. and so it was a relief to actually work in a shop where you were lugging the things around instead of deconstructing them. And one of the members of staff at the bookshop took me literally by the hand to a bookshelf and said, I think you'll like this book. And she took out Barbara Trepido's Brother the More Famous Jack. And I absolutely fell in love with it. I've read it so many times. It's kind of my comfort book. And I remember in just 6 weeks after I arrived at the Independent, where I became deputy literary editor after I'd been running the Poetry Society, I was asked to apply for the job there. Quite a big deal to give it up. But I thought, if I ever want to be a journalist, this is my chance. So I went to the Indie. 6 weeks after I arrived there, I found I had a lump in my breast, which obviously was not ideal. And I then had to go and have it cut out. And a few days after I came out of hospital, I was booked to interview Barbara Trepido. And so it was a very, very emotional time for me. And I went and I interviewed her and she was absolutely lovely. I think she's a wonderful writer. Oh, how lovely.
Oh, my goodness.
That's funny. That's I just found an email in a printed out email in this book.
Is there anything that you can share in the email? If you totally understand, you'd rather keep it private. But I'm a super fan of Barbara Trepido and she's been a writer I've returned to many times during...
So she says, I've actually last managed to take my draft novel out of its box where it's been lying for 18 months and start polishing it to final draft. Blah, blah, blah. So she's talking about her latest book.
Where did you interview her?
I think I interviewed her in a cafe, actually, because I was not at all well and I just was literally a few days out of hospital. I think I might even have still had drips, a drip for... you know, blood and stuff in my pocket. I was very frail. So actually, retrospectively, it was completely crazy to do it.
This edition of Brother of the More Famous Jack, may I?
Yes.
This looks so loved and so right. I've never seen this cover before. It's beautiful. It's kind of a tapestry effect, I think. God, that is the most glamorous author picture on the front. It's gorgeous. It's got this really kind of... Do you think that was maybe taken in the 60s or 70s? It's got a real... who's that? You know who I mean. Francis. It's a French singer.
Yeah.
Francois Hardy.
Thank you, Dale.
1982, this was. So I imagine it was around then, actually, or late 70s. God, I don't even recognise... I've got my name in it. I don't even recognise my handwriting. It bears no resemblance to the scroll.
That's an interesting habit, because I don't think I've ever done that, putting my name in a book.
When that kind of
fell out, was that, do you think, from when books were more... It's terrible, isn't it? When you get sent a lot of books, you get quite cavalier about lending them. And when you know you have more than you will ever possibly read.
Yes.
It was from a time when we all had less money and books seemed more expensive,
But I still obsessively buy books. I buy books all the time instead of reading them. I have this sort of tremendous hunger. When I go into a bookshop, I feel kind of sick with envy at all the fantastic books that other people have written that I haven't written. And then sick that I'm never going to have the time to read them all. And kind of also joyous because it's like being in the biggest cake shop in the whole world. It's a very funny mix of feelings.
I'm so glad it's not just me. I feel that much more acutely as someone who writes books now, there's a real, sometimes I go in and think, oh no, like I just want there to be one time I want to go in and there's only books by me.
I know.
Which is obviously dreadful, and feeling, I think, wholeheartedly positive about the experience before.
Oh, absolutely. Well, normally I just, you know, kind of consumed by envy, but as it happens, my books just come out in paperback, and it's kind of, I found it in a pile on a W.H. Smith Travel,
which was an incredible thrill.
I think it's a temporary promotion, but it was still an incredible thrill because usually it's kind of tucked away in some hidden corner.
Was there a picture on your Instagram, but it was prominently displayed?
Yes,
because I did, you know, you said when we talked before about having more books than you'll ever possibly read, being obviously sent so many books because those people are hoping that you'll review them. And also, it sounds like, just because I do it, I buy books, I don't get round to reading immediately. What's the oldest book you think you have that you've bought and not read?
Oh my goodness. Where would I start on that? I did finally read War and Peace. That was, I hadn't read that for many, many years. And then I had a week in... Funny enough, Barbara Trepido refers to it in her email. I had a week when I wasn't very well some years ago. I had a week in Sharm el Sheikh, and there was a new translation of War and Peace, and I took that with me and was absolutely enchanted and riveted by it. I've definitely, to my shame, never read Joyce's Finnegan Wake, but I'm not even sure I've got it actually.
Was it what prompted you to read War and Peace? I've never read it, and I feel ashamed of that, but. It is. It's possibly the ultimate book that everybody believes they're going to get round to.
Yes.
A bit like, I think, it's almost like writing a book, isn't it? I just need that, you know, perfect sort of free 6-month period that never actually turns up. And was it that the fear of not getting around to it is greater than...
Well, I was in a very bad way, actually. I was very unwell and I was in a lot of pain and I was kind of desperate because I couldn't get better. And I don't know whether... I think... that book had arrived, that translation had arrived in the office, and I think I just thought, okay, I have some time now, why not read it? And I read it, you know, in a week, and I remember again sitting by a pool with some chocolate cake and coffee. There's a bit of a continuing theme here. And just utterly immersed in the world and thinking, this is just an extraordinary book. I did also feel that about Anna Karenina, which I read many years before, that was my father's favourite book, actually, Anna Karenina. Somebody who I've discovered in recent years, I've just seen her book, who I absolutely love, is Elizabeth Strout. I don't know if you've read her, but she is an amazing writer. You just read her and think, this is what life is like. And her books, to my joy, are getting shorter, because I do think as I get older and life gets shorter that there's a lot to be said for brevity. So the last one I read of hers is Anything is Possible, which is... wonderfully short and
that's
also
a beautiful
amazing.
Edition. Is that a proof?
That's a proof, yeah. She wrote My Name is Lucy Barton.
Yes, and, that I
and The Burgess
really
Boys and
that.
Olive Kitteridge.
You do write so much about current affairs and the world around us. And, you know, we were talking before as well, when you have to read for information and research, you do have less time to read for pleasure. Do you like books that reflect your world or books that take you away from it, or do you think it's important to have a combination of the two?
I don't really read escapism. Obviously fiction is in a sense escapism, but I've never been a fan of crime fiction. When I was a teenager, I loved Mary Stuart, I suppose you'd call them romantic thrillers. Now I don't really want to read, I'm not really interested in genre writing. I suppose, partly having had cancer twice, I do feel intensely aware that life is very short, and I'm not a particularly fast reader, unfortunately, which, you know, you'd have thought seeing all these books I was, but I'm not. These books have absorbed a lot of my life, and when I'm reviewing a book I'm quite slow, and also when I'm obviously reading, mostly I review non-fiction these days, and I'm not really reading them for information, I'm reading them for the kind of, you know, to see how good the book is and learn in the process. So I love to read a really good novel, but I want that novel to feel like this is what life is. So one novel I absolutely loved, which I did review actually, is called All My Puny Sorrows by Miriam Toys, and it's funny and sad and really, really beautiful. I've just started reading Jonathan Coe's Middle England, which I'm hugely enjoying, and I think it's a kind of I haven't got very far with it, but utterly absorbing and illustrate a dramatization of what feels like the key moment of our lifetimes, which is Brexit. So I do like fiction to illuminate and feel truthful. For me, it's all back to Keats, beauty and truth. Mm. That's what it comes down to, really. I want everything to be about beauty and truth.
I love Jonathan Coe, and I love his I love him as sort of as a satirist and his sort of, you know, very wicked, very observant eye. But the novel of his I think I love the most is The House of Sleep, which I think of all the, you know, because he's so good at writing about time and place. Mm. And in some ways, I think that is the least connected with time and place. But I think I love the very different descriptions of humanity. I thought there was just so much nuance in those relationships. And in some ways, that seemed like the most real to me, because it's very much about people. I think all novels are ultimately about desire, not necessarily sexual romantic desire, but it's about what we want and how we're defined by what we want, and how we, I think, come adrift when we forget what we want or we don't know it, or we think we want something else. And that's what I really loved about that book.
That's very interesting. I think you're probably right. I mean, I think probably my favourite is What a Carve Up, just because it's so funny, but it's a long time since read that.
Really magnificent comic writing.
I also think that comic writing is often undervalued, actually, and it's one of the hardest things to do.
I'm always banging on about this, that I think that so much writing is dismissed because it's easy to read. When the easier something is to read, the harder it is to write.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. It's incredibly hard to... I mean, I find...
War and Peace. I thought that was easy to write. I just knocked it off.
I speak quite polysyllabically, but I try very hard in my writing to take out the long words, which is quite time consuming. And, you know, you want your writing to be a quick read. And one of the things I love about Elizabeth Strout is that her writing is very plain, sort of, you know, cut back, unvarnished. I don't think everybody has to write like Raymond Carver, but you're absolutely right. I think deceptive simplicity really is what it's about, and so is writing in an entertaining way. It's incredibly hard to do, and comedy is very hard to do, and we needed satire more, really.
Yes, and it's the rhythm and the musicality that makes something funny so often, isn't it? I think that's the writing more than any other way. You have to hear it.
Yes, exactly.
As you read it.
Exactly, yeah.
Let's go over here, because you mentioned Iris Murdoch.
Oh, yes.
A happy reading memory. And I see some beautiful old masses of art just moved out.
I think I did my dissertation on Iris Murdoch, actually.
Can you remember what it's called?
I think it was called something like A Lucky Dip of Meanings.
Ooh.
Something and something in Iris Murdoch's prose. Some pretentious subtitle.
It sounds like you were reading her early.
I think I stumbled upon her as a teenager, actually, and I really loved her then. I don't know what I would make of her now. I suspect I might find her a bit mannered now. And all those sort of, you know, you kind of need endless Venn diagrams for all the relationships. I don't know how I'd feel about that now. But I do remember when, I think in one of her, I'm trying to think which one it was, she said, anyone can fall in love with anyone, which I thought was such a true thing to say, and might have been in The Sacred and Profane Love Machine. I haven't read her for so long. Have you read her recently?
Not recently. And I think I read The Sea in my teens, and it all went over my head. And there was that, I mean, in a way, I think the pretentiousness of your teenage years, being very proud of her, pretentiousness of one's teenage years is a brilliant, brilliant thing, because it's a time when you do feel like Adrian Mole, and you are imagining the person you'd be and building yourself through books. Mm. And there are things like, you know, I was thinking about what you were saying about the shortness of life, and perhaps with certain books like War and Peace, there are books that you're either going to read when mortality hits you and you suddenly become aware that you're human and you are going to die. Mm. I'm 33 and I don't actually believe I'm going to die. I think they will have invented something by the time it comes for me.
If you were called Jesus.
I might be quite nervous because it's my birthday soon. Oh. And we've just had Christmas. My time is running out. But I do think that I know about death, like, intellectually, but not yet really. I think that's coming for me, and I think I'm a late developer in that respect.
No, I think none of us really thinks we're going to die. And I was 36 I was 39 when I got cancer for the first time. And then I thought, oh God, you know, I might die. And that was a terrible shock. And obviously we all know we're going to die. And then I got it again when I was 46, I think.
But I don't really believe it now. I sort of do and I sort of don't. But I must say death is sort of featuring more. That sounds like a ridiculous thing to say. But obviously, as you get older, you know more people who do die.
You've written about this beautifully. And I'm not just saying this because you're here. I absolutely would recommend that everybody listening read your book and how you've written about it. But the only way I can put it is fucking hell. You know, twice to go through everything that you have to go through physically and emotionally, and then to have that happen again. I mean, were you angry?
Yeah, sure. But, well, I don't know that I was angry. I just felt cheated, actually. And the honest truth is that, and this is sad, and this is, as you know, one of the themes in my book, in a way, was that I did think, oh, my God, if I die now, my life will have been a failure, which now seems like an incredibly harsh assessment of a life. But it was genuinely what I thought at the time. I had just been dumped by someone I was in love with. And I thought, I'm not married. I don't have a family. The expectation in my family was always that you would have do that conventional stuff. I didn't do it. And I thought, oh, my God, you know, I'm not ready. I'm not ready to go. And also I the thought of having to go through what I was told I would have to go through, mastectomy and chemo and all the rest of it. I just thought, you know what? I just can't effing do this.
You can swear, by the way.
Well, I do all the time, but you never know. But and luckily, in the end, I didn't need chemo. And I did have to have a mastectomy, which I was absolutely dreading. I would lie awake at night. I would Google pictures of mastectomies and just feel completely sick. But in fact, and it was horrible, but I had a fantastic surgeon. He did a brilliant job of reconstructing at the same time. And it was all fine. So what is amazing, I suppose I've never had a baby, but I suppose it's like childbirth that women say you forget the pain of childbirth. And it now feels a long time ago. And I'm not really, I know some people do like to think of themselves as, you know, a survivor of cancer and go to cancer support groups and things like that. And I absolutely respect anybody's right to respond to these things any way they like. But I didn't want to talk to anyone else who'd had cancer. I didn't really want to meet anyone who had cancer. I didn't want to go to any support groups. And unless it kind of comes up in conversation, I'm not particularly interested in it because I've been there, I've done that. It was horrible. And let's get on with life, really.
I imagine there's nothing new that you can learn about it or about you. You don't need anybody else's experiences alongside your own. And I think it's fine to feel that way. And something I really, really adore about reading, especially now, and something I'm trying to cherish, is I've been struggling, especially at the moment, with social media. And it sounds awful, doesn't it? Because I feel like as humans, we should be open and we should be interactive. We should want to have conversations. But the spaces where that was happening, they're not really the right place for that anymore. And the heaven of a book is reading about either a real experience or an imagined experience that sounds so real, and you can take what you need to and be nourished by that. Yes. But you don't have to kind of go in and parcel it back to them. You don't have someone else coming and parceling your own experience and serving it back to you.
Yes, absolutely right. I mean, all this kind of let's open up the conversation. It's like, let's not. I really don't want any more conversations. I want to hear from people whose opinions I respect. And I'm afraid I'm at a point now, I think human beings have always, we can all learn from other human beings in all kinds of ways. But I'm not going to learn about the nuances of Brexit. I might know someone's opinion about Brexit, but I'm not going to learn about the likely economic implications of Brexit from someone who hasn't done, hasn't sort of taken a lot of time to invest in the issues and, you know, read a lot about it. I feel like I could now do a PhD about it, but alas, nobody's paying me to do that. And
listen,
similarly,
if anybody would like to fund, I think this is truly what we need to move forward.
And similarly, to go back to your point about, do I feel I've got anything to learn about cancer? I feel I've got something to learn from anyone who has thought about something a lot and can express it beautifully. So I will happily read a book about someone going through breast cancer or prostate cancer or arthritis or whatever else they have been through, if they do it beautifully. I will also happily read, I don't particularly, but I would happily read
a crime novel if it was beautifully done. I loved, for example, watching The Killing. I watch very little TV, but on various holidays I've taken box sets of things like The Killing and thought it was pretty much a masterpiece. I think you can talk or write about anything if you do it well. And for me, that's kind of the only rule, really.
Yeah.
And that's why I get quite impatient of all this. You can't say this, you can't say that. I kind of think, I understand, of course, that there are legal barriers you can't step over and, you know, hate crime and so on. And in fact, this week, somebody has been held in custody because of their communication towards me and has been charged for malicious communication because he did cross a line. But, and we have to respect that. But in terms of you might offend so-and-so, we're fine to offend people. That is fine. It's called free speech. And I don't think there's anything you can't write about as long as you do it brilliantly.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
We'll be back to Christina soon, but now it's time for my steal of the week, a book I loved so much that I should have paid for it with golden rubies instead of a Visa debit card. This week it's The Art of Being a Woman by Patricia Volk, published by Random House in 2013. This is a memoir about fashion and family. In the mid-50s, Volk found her mother's copy of Shocking Life, the autobiography of the radical fashion designer Elsa Schiaparelli, and it changed her understanding of womanhood and style forever. This is a beautiful book about celebrating rule-breaking and challenging the establishment. The writing really is as elegant as the clothes Volk is describing. If, like me, you're a Mad Men fanatic and you're fascinated with stories of life in mid-century Manhattan, I promise you'll adore this. That's The Art of Being a Woman by Patricia Volk, published by Random House and out now. Now back to Christina.
Who are your favourite writers on bodies? And as someone who I'm assuming, having had cancer, you've got a very, your relationship with your body, I think, has probably kind of evolved and changed over time.
Yes, it has.
Who do you think kind of captures what it is to have a body?
That's such an interesting question. Goodness. Funny enough, I've got an essay in a book that's come out called Under the Skin, which is about the organs of the body. And my essay is about the skin, but I've only just started reading it, so I read a couple of them and they're really good. One by A.L. Kennedy and one by Naomi Alderman.
A.L. Kennedy. The Little Snake was one of my favourite books last
Which
year.
Which one?
The Little Snake.
I haven't read that, but I have read a fair bit of A.L. Kennedy. Gosh, that's such an
recommend
question.
And it's short.
Right, that's always great.
Blissfully short.
So, Doris Lessing. I'm just thinking of Doris Lessing. And
because I was going to ask you
The Golden Notebook, actually.
Doris Lessing.
I remember reading that as a teenager. And I remember her talking, I think I remember her talking about periods and being kind of shocked and also sort of delighted. I remember the embarrassment of having periods on holiday and, you know, what did you do if you got, you know, a stain on a skirt and your dad was there and all of that stuff. So I think Doris Lessing writes very powerfully about what it is to be sexual and to be a woman.
Because I loved Martha Quest, and I think that's one of the first books I read with a female protagonist who wasn't always sympathetic, or rather she seemed much more authentic because she could be a real dick. And yes. She was selfish and cruel and thoughtless. And that seemed kind of quietly revolutionary in a way.
Yes, I think that might have been Martha Quest. I think that might have been the first Doris Lessing I read. I interviewed her when she was 80 and went to the loo in her house and she had a Chinese dictionary on. She was learning Chinese at 80. Can you imagine?
Oh, no, that's what you do when you think you're going to die, isn't it?
Because
that's what I was going to say before, whether you either the books you own, you can only read when you're at a certain point in youth or a certain point in ageing. Mm. And it's the middle bit where you're kind of possibly your most insecure and when you also think you have the most time to improve, where, you know, you think one day I'll read Tolstoy and I'll learn Chinese. And then when you have either a notion of yourself as someone who reads Tolstoy and knows Chinese or a notion that you've only got another few years to do so, that's when that happens.
Well, I'm never going to learn Chinese. I'm telling you that for nothing. But I would like to get my Italian back, which used to be quite good and is now absolutely awful. But,
does it come back when you're there?
A bit, but in fact, I just started doing Duolingo a bit.
I was just going to ask you if you had Duolingo.
I haven't been using it nearly enough, and I did learn...
Do you have the completely mad sentences where you're translating things that, I bet you say that to all the boys, and I've got a massive aubergine.
Last night, actually, I was really, really tired, and I've got a book to review, and I keep, obviously, every day get these things saying, it's time for your lesson. I've only registered for 5 minutes and I still manage to not do it most days. But then I've only been trying for about 10 days. But I did quite enjoy it, because I used to be very good at Italian. So I'm at the level where I started from scratch. So it's quite easy. But also some of the sentences I can't remember now, but, you know, the horses have a marrow or something, you know, something quite weird. And
I'm sure on the French one, I had a man saying, will you hold my snake? Is there anyone who you would love to interview?
I know Kazuo Ishiguro a tiny bit. I actually knew him when I worked at Faber many years ago.
I interviewed him quite early on
when I was at the Indy. And in fact, my mother taught his sister at primary school. And she used to bump into Mrs. Ishiguro on Guildford High Street. He is both a wonderful writer and a really lovely man.
Go into the Penguin bookshop and do kind of cover face outs and things and make sure that his books are within the main tables.
I don't know. No. Very modest Japanese woman. I doubt very much she would have done that. Let's see who else. John Burnside, I think, is a wonderful writer. I interviewed him many years ago. In fact, I chaired a thing with him at the British Library a year or two ago. He's a fantastic writer. He's a brilliant poet. He's very unusually versatile and prolific. He's a brilliant poet, brilliant novelist, and brilliant memoirist. Really, really, really good.
I hate him already.
I know, absolutely.
What are his novels about?
They are
A Summer of Drowning, The Mercy Boys, and The Locust Room, and is that him as well? Burning Elvis.
Ooh. Nature is a very big theme, and doubles are a big theme. And goodness, they're very difficult to sum up. They're very difficult. They're very, very difficult to describe. I'm really stumbling here, but I think he's an amazing writer. He writes a lot about, there are lots of undercurrents of violence, actually, in his work. So he's great.
It's funny, isn't it? Because I do find you can have a Dan Brown or a Jack Reacher book, and if someone said, what's it about? And you're like, well, you know, they're in this building and this person comes along and this explodes. And actually, some of the novels I've really, really loved that have made the biggest impact on me, someone says, what's it about?
I know, you can't. I have no idea. I know, but it's funny you mentioned Jack Reacher, because I don't read thrillers at all. But I was asked to do an event at a crime festival with Lee Child. I remember sitting in a friend's kitchen and feeling almost crying, because I thought, how am I going to do this thing when it's going to be full of 500 Lee Child fans? I've never read a Lee Child book in my life, and I've never read any other thrillers either. So I did read some, and I thought they were really good. It was fascinating conversation, so I really enjoyed that.
Do you have any favourite love stories, or not necessarily romantic novels, but those two, but romances in books that have stayed in your head as either inspiring stories or cautionary tales, or a bit of both?
Oh, goodness.
This is possibly not the most straightforward jumping off point, but I found Candace Bushnell,
who
I'm a huge fan of. And
me
I do
too.
Think her writing does not get the respect it deserves. But she is, you know, writing, I think, in a very smart and anthropological way.
Absolutely.
About love and relationships.
Absolutely. Well, I loved, I was mad about the series. It felt like,
you know, I mean, I felt like I was living the unglamorous version of it at the time that it was on. And I think she is a very good writer. I interviewed her, actually, and she's one of the few writers I found quite disappointing. I didn't like her at all. And also, interestingly, I think her earlier novels or short stories, I think Second City is kind of linked to short stories, do have a slightly kind of razor-like, almost Jane Austen-like sort of forensic sense. But
there's a real kind of, I think, darkness and bleakness to them that I really enjoyed. And I loved the series too. I've gone through many sort of, you know, loving and hating and then loving of it. But and it was, I think, necessary for it to seem sort of super glossy and super aspirational. Yes. That's how they sold it. But yes, there's a real dark heart in those stories.
And she's actually very good on relationships and very good on sex. I think, I mean, this is not what one would expect. It's not how you would expect to answer your question. But, and it, I wouldn't say that I was haunted by the love stories in them, but I do think she writes or can write very truthfully about the realities of sex and romance.
It's unusual to have that honesty, because I think that often in quite a lot of, it's like, you know, with films, isn't it? The love story is a sort of a secondary thing that gets, you know, thrown in. And then if the novel is about a relationship, it's dismissed as being, you know, especially with commercial women's fiction, when actually that's, I think, one of the most universal things is who we are in and out of relationships. Because they're the one thing we have, I think, far less control there than we do, say, sort of our jobs and where we live and...
Absolutely. Love and death, it's kind of it really, isn't it?
But what, can I ask why she was disappointing? When was the interview?
Oh, I think it was around something like 2008 or 9.
So that, has it just finished? Or, so presumably the show was at the peak of it.
Yes, she had a new novel out, which I think was One Fifth Avenue, which was, and what was not, and it was sort of full of very, very rich people living at One Fifth Avenue, which is you know, the kind of one of the smartest buildings in
one high
exactly
park
exactly
Manhattan.
And I suppose what I felt was, it felt as though I kind of assumed it was satire, and then I realized I wasn't quite sure that it was satire, that there was a sort of slight aspirational sense of sort of yearning for that lifestyle. And I felt as though she'd perhaps been sucked into the whole thing. She told me off for, she, you know, I sort of mentioned I was single, and she kind of wagged her finger at me and said, you're waiting, you know, if you're waiting for someone to bring home the bacon. And I thought, well, I'm not waiting for anyone to bring home the bacon. I found her quite stern, and she insisted on bringing her own hair and makeup person
to
the interview. Yeah, with a photograph.
God, I wish we could do that when we're in certain publications that shall remain nameless and being wedged into our nude heels with our Shirley Temple calves.
Exactly, yes. Yes.
I guess, even though you met her and you were there, and I want to defend her because I've loved her work so much, but also you think, well, probably couldn't produce what she has produced and be in that position without a certain, I don't know, maybe like a brittle quality or feeling as though people kind of expect things from you. I'm interested in how writing and being published, it seems like the most public and the most private thing you can do at the same time.
So I think a lot of writers, genuinely, their way of being out in the public arena was really things like literary festivals, going to Hay on Wye, doing interviews. When I started, I worked at the South Bank Centre on the literature programme from 1990 to 1998. And it wasn't a big thing then, doing public literary events. That was the first literary programme in London. It was the biggest in the country. There were a few literary festivals, but not masses. There's a whole proliferation now. And lots of people found it you know, quite challenging to be out and back. I did meet some amazing people, Umberto Eco and Octavia Paz and Derek Woolcott, and, you know, all kinds of people. But I think the one who remains for me the most impressive, although sadly he's no longer with us, is Seamus Heaney. I mean, he was, even before he won the Nobel Prize, he was a kind of megastar. And whenever he did events, there would be, you know, kind of hundreds of people queuing up, all claiming to be his second cousin. And he was unfailingly polite and lovely to all of them. He was obviously a fantastic writer, but a really phenomenal human being. And I think one of the others, as I mentioned earlier, is Kazuo Ishiguro. He is, as far as I can tell, unfailingly courteous and polite. I'm sure he doesn't do social media. He just is a thoroughly decent, nice person who also happens to be a Nobel Prize winning wonderful writer. And I'll tell you an example of one who isn't. I just recently reviewed the Hemingway biography. And I mean, it's hard to imagine. I think The Old Man and the Sea, for example, is one of the most beautiful pieces of writing in the English language. The guy was an absolute shit. I mean, I had no idea what a shit he was, but a complete compulsive liar, not just philanderer, but deeply, maliciously cruel to almost everyone he came in contact with, made things up, self-aggrandizing. And it raises the ever pertinent issue of how you can be an amazing artist and a truly terrible human being.
Did you read, as a writer called, I'm going to say her name wrong, Claire Derrida? I think she wrote this for the Paris Review, and it was about that, about this, you know, more, I think she was talking specifically about Roman Polanski, but being a huge fan of these men who have now, you know, it's come to our attention they're problematic, but what it's like when you have sort of based your teenage self around your passion for this work, and how that does really seem to really, really happen to men so much, that when you're a man, everyone is in a great hurry to separate your personal life from your work, and when you're a woman, there's no breaking point. There's no division at all. It's like you are this.
I think that's exactly right. And I know you mentioned Woody Allen in the Dolly Alderton podcast, and it's a very familiar story. I think you judge people as human beings, but their work is their work, and you can't start looking at it through a prism of how many old ladies did they visit, were they ever unfaithful to their wife. It's a separate thing. And I mean, Tolstoy was not a nice man, and Mozart, you know, well, we don't know because Amadeus is misleading, but we just don't know. You just don't know. I certainly do think that women have been sort of unfairly judged, and then you get the kind of whole Jane Austen thing of, oh, you know, dried up spinster in her, you know, doing her needlework or her looking at her little inch of ivory or whatever. I hope that those classifications are disappearing.
You know, you've talked about all the awful experiences you've had of being someone with a public facing job and having abuse that, you know, no person should ever, ever, ever have to deal with that. But also the vulnerability that you have when you write of, you know, what you are giving away of yourself, and whether it's sane and sensible to kind of to build a bit of a shell, and whether even, you know, Seamus Heaney was performing.
Yes, I'm sure he was up to a point. I think in one sense, you know, there's a sense in which we all do when, I mean, you know, I could be slumped on the sofa at home with my bloke, and then we'll, you know, maybe go to see some friends and, you know, suddenly sparkling company. I'm certainly not like that at home, you know. I think we all do a kind of putting a, you know, good show on. But I think probably women have felt more of a pressure to be nice. I think we do feel more of a pressure to be nice. And I've always had this thing where I suppose in very often in a kind of, you know, if I'm on telly talking about something in the news, I'll probably feel slightly freer to be a bit more aggressive with a bloke than I will with a woman. Mm. If I'm on with a woman, I probably feel a kind of default thing of, which may be the wrong way around, or, you know, an unconventional way around, I probably feel I need to be nicer to the woman than I do to the bloke. Whereas I have never been frightened to argue. I had a very, very argumentative father. I mean, you know, very lovely father, but he was sort of intellectually like a kind of juggernaut and brilliant. And when he died, I bought my mother a fridge magnet that said, "When I met Mr. Wright, I didn't realise his first name would be Always." You know, that was his kind of tone. And sometimes, and I did notice when I was younger, I'd sort of hear myself speaking, think, "Oh my God, I'm speaking in the same sort of horrendously patronising tone as my father now." And I've got a little bit better, or rather, probably considerably better on that front. But I have never really, I don't know quite why, but I haven't felt that too much, that impetus of I have to tone myself down to be nice to the boys. They've got to like me. Mm. And I think, you know, they didn't particularly like me. I think I very often came across when as quite spiky and, you know, sort of barbed wire around me and possibly a bit aggressive. So in a way, I'm quite pleased that I didn't feel I had to kind of turn myself down, because I do know a few women who I would say are fiercely intelligent, who wouldn't necessarily instantly know how bright they are because their demeanour is more kind of, you know, nice.
So we are now in Christina's hall. I should say as well that this flat used to be a school or part of a school. So I don't know what if this, I think the sitting room we thought might be a classroom. Do you think this is, I don't know.
I don't know.
Had their dinner?
Maybe this was the head teacher's room or something. Who knows?
There's lots of, I don't know, I suppose, how much of it is new. But there's interesting slopey bits in the ceiling and it feels quite grown up in here. And these some seriously grown up books. Ooh, that is a very well-found looking copy of Roland Barthes.
I can't remember a single thing about
him. I don't even know how to pronounce
Barthes, I think.
Barthes. I always want to do a bit of a mad sort of Barthes.
Roland Barthes, I don't know.
Like it's a delicious cheese.
If only.
Image, music, text. This is, all, is this from when
you
were studying?
From my UEA. I cannot remember a single thing about it.
Why did you keep it?
Because obviously I'm going to read these all again one day.
Definitely. And it's... a lot of intellectual heft to have that.
And obviously I want people to think I'm very, very intellectual, yes.
And this has just caught my eye. And I love this because this is definitely, I think, a book that's been displayed. It is book and ornament. I'm going to be very careful with it because it's very fragile. Every Woman's Book of Health and Beauty. It's got a marvellous, can you describe the cover?
I know, I love it. I haven't, a friend gave it to me actually. And in 2008, very, very, it's just a beautiful old retro book. And it's got... sort of, you know, advice on.
Oh, is there some really good bad diet
so
advice?
It's health and beauty and so on. Let's think, see
so
when it was
published
from.
In...
Let's try and see the date now. It's clearly very old, but it's not saying.
It's sort of funny, I think, that it says first edition, that they're expecting there to be more.
It says slimming with safety, physical culture, and then it's got brilliant... now, what would you say? When would you say that was?
I thought, looking at the cover, I would guess... late 40s, early 50s.
Yes, I would have thought that, yes.
So this is...
Exercises for slim through middle. I think my dear friend, the poet Maura Dooley, gave this to me probably because she knew about my self-help obsession. And I'm afraid those books have disappeared because I ran out of space. But as you know from reading my book, I used to be a massive fan of self-help books purely for entertainment. I never followed any of the advice in any of them. I used to have loads of diet books, and this is just beautiful.
So,
and of course, Nora Ephron,
and that is I Remember Nothing,
which is kind of my life now, but yes, and they are brilliant.
What do you have a favorite?
Journalism, a Love Story, that's a great one about how she fell in love with journalism. Yeah, I love that. I don't know if it's my favourite. I can't remember which is my favourite. Needless to say, because it's I'm remembering nothing.
And I can see, because I know you said there's some poetry upstairs. There's a fabulous chunk of poetry. I see Lorca. I see Robbie Burns. Mm. I get really quite do that. But then when people call them Robbie Burns, I'm like, did you know him? Were you around him?
Robert Burns life to you. Yes.
When do you read poetry?
Do you know, these days, not nearly enough. I recently, a friend of mine who's a poet, who's in my book actually, asked me to look at her latest collection, which isn't published yet, and I read that. I don't read, but I kind of got out of the habit of reading poetry, which is a shame because, again, I think, you know, poetry is kind of balm to the soul, really.
And I think it's what we were talking about with comedy as well, the rhythm of language.
Absolutely.
And that it's not writing that's purely content. It's... more than the sum of its parts.
Exactly, yeah.
You've worked with poetry and with poets in a professional context. Did you love poetry before that, or is that something that you grew to love more in your professional life?
Well, I did grow to love it more. As someone who studied English, I was obviously always keen on poetry. I always found it very hard to write about poetry, and I still find it very hard to write about poetry. I remember many years ago being asked to review some poetry books for the New Statesman and slightly freaking out. I ran the Poetry Society for 3 years, and I did obviously write about poetry then, but I don't feel very comfortable as a critic of poetry. Not that I can't tell what's good, but I don't feel I'm brilliant on form, which is really vital. You really, really need to know your forms.
If I were to say, I'm not going to make you do it, but if I would say, recite a poem now, what would be the poem?
Well, I'm mad about Keats, actually. I've been reading Keats again recently, and I feel like I wish I'd met him, because everything, if you kind of keep coming back to your sort of core values, everybody now wants you to talk about what are your core values, and I just rather pathetically just keep coming back to the thing in Odin and Grishina, and it's beauty and truth, you know, that's all you know on earth and all you need to know. So and also negative capability, which I feel we're in rather, you know, lacking at the moment in our public debate.
I don't really think I understand what that means, which is maybe my millennial.
It's from a letter of his, and he talks about being in uncertainties, mysteries and doubts, and it's our ability to cope with mystery and doubt rather than having to be certain about everything all the time. I love Keats.
Oh, yes, that's something I would very much like to read that. I think that sounds a lot like...
Well, should we have a look at the poetry book?
Yeah.
Let's go to that as we're on poetry.
Okay, up on the mezzanine. I'm very excited about it because I was hoping to have a look at the mezzanine. I'm just going to invite myself over for dinner. These are beautifully painted bookcases as well.
No, they're not painted, they're just IKEA Billy ready-made bookcases. Which happened to fit perfectly in that space by pure coincidence.
Proper library. Is this all poetry?
Yes. Before me. Oh, I love Carver, Raymond Carver's poetry. Do you know his poem Late Fragment?
Not well.
Oh, it's absolutely it's incredible. I'll
read
it.
Can you see him here?
That's
lovely.
Like a few lines. Just amazing. Right, I can find it. And did you get what you wanted from this life, even so? I did. And what did you want? To call myself beloved, to feel myself beloved on the earth. Isn't it beautiful? I read that at my sister's funeral.
Oh, Christina. I'm not sure there are many podcasts where people are like, I'm now hugging everyone.
Another poet I love who's brilliant and accepts simplicity, Wendy Coates.
Oh, I was I was wondering, because I lit on that book, Two Cures for Love, and I was wondering, you guys are talking about love and relationships, maybe Wendy Coates is the master.
I love Wendy Coates. I really love her. I was thrilled, actually. She sent me an email saying how much she loved my book, and I didn't even know she'd read it. I was absolutely thrilled.
Oh, how wonderful. Mm. Is she someone you know? Have you interviewed her?
I did interview her, yes, and I do know her a bit. In the poetry world, there are a lot of poets I know. I just love her, and particularly Serious
Concern. I just opened up. I'm going to read this out because it's so good and it's so short. Two cures for love. One, don't see him. Yeah. Don't phone or write a letter. Two, the easy way, get to know him better.
Exactly. I love it. It's one. Loss. The day he moved out was terrible. That evening she went through hell. His absence wasn't a problem, but the corkscrew had gone as well. And here's a lovely, lovely one. As sweet. It's all because we're so alike, twin souls, we two. We smile at the expression, yes, and know it's true. I told the shrink, he gave our love a different name, but he can call it what he likes, it's still the same. I long to see you, hear your voice, my narcissistic object choice.
Is this making you want to spend more time reading poetry?
Yes,
it is me,
definitely.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I don't really know, but I think it's perhaps because nothing is ever wasted in a good poem.
Yeah.
It's a really, really pure form. I think there's something about the time that you give to it. You don't, you know, sometimes with a novel, you do get a bit of time to kind of to warm up, and you can maybe not pay attention for half a page and something grabs you and you're in. But with poetry, it's all or nothing. You've got to be there. And perhaps in these times, I keep saying, that phrase is becoming more and more meaningless the more I say it. In these times when everything is terrible and no one cares, we can only ever concentrate for half a second. Mm. It's poetry asks a lot of us,
yes.
But maybe we should be giving
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. Yeah.
If you've not read these...
Let's see what I've read. We've obviously got some got Pride and Prejudice, which funny enough I have read, and Wuthering Heights, which I have read.
Have you read these editions or
probably? Oh, I might have read this edition of Wuthering Heights. I've had that since I was a child. And
so these are all kind of, you know, leather bound. If you did a Google image search of kind of, you know, beautiful old books or, you know, classy old book library, this is what you get. I see leather and gilt, and in some cases those beautiful kind of frayed ribbons. What is that fabric? It's not quite...
This, I don't think this is leather. Some of these are.
Those, pleather. Those were, cloth and
those,
pleather.
Those Walter Scott's were my great-grandfather's, I think, but I haven't read them. Oh, wow, this my grandmother gave this to me when I was... I would have been 6 or 7. My dear little Christina, with every good wish and best love from her own Mama May, my grandmother.
The Wuthering Heights is quite a powerful book for a 7-year-old.
I know,
is that an illustration of the author?
Yes.
And that's Emily Bronte, looking quite
on Emily Bronte like.
Well, I don't know about you, but that looks like someone collapsing on a checker. Bloody hell, I've written a book. As if it was drawn the second she finished. When can you remember when you read it?
That seems a bit young, doesn't it?
I'm going to come up because my knees are killing me.
Oh yes, I probably read it. Maybe I was about 12 or something like that, and it's such a kind of wild book, isn't it? It's a kind of scary thing to read in a way, because it's so full of fierce and slightly dangerous energy. This will sound like name dropping, but when I interviewed Gordon Brown...
Emily Bronte.
Yeah, when I interviewed Gordon Brown, I really did think Heathcliff, actually, he did that. And also Ted Hughes definitely had that sort of Heathcliff sense.
So you met Ted Hughes, who I'm much more excited about than Gordon Brown.
Oh, right. Yeah, no, I met him quite a few times. I suppose I must have met him certainly when I worked at the South Bank, and probably when I worked at Faber. I worked at Faber for a year when I was 25 or 26. So, no, I mean, I've never met anyone with such sort of raw magnetism. It's astonishing.
There's a story that producer Dale knows better than I that's maybe apocryphal anecdote about a woman sitting next to Ted Hughes at a dinner party and finding him so charismatic that she had to go and be sick.
Really? Really? That doesn't surprise me, actually. That doesn't surprise me. I remember getting in a cab with him and with a female poet who'd better be nameless, and she was practically throwing herself at him. The word magnetism was kind of made for him. I mean, I really liked him.
Was it
Pamela? I hardly knew him, but no, it wasn't. But it was not. It was not a young woman. in fact, I knew her daughter. Yeah, astonishing man. But he really did live his life in the terrible, terrible shadow of Sylvia, and I think he was always tormented by that. And in fact, when some of his letters were sold, so he died in, I think, 1998. Or maybe 99, I think it must have been in something like 2000, the British Library acquired some of his letters to the critic Keith Sagar, and I was summoned in by The Guardian to go and look at those letters, and it was really thrilling to be at the British Library and be handling these original letters. And I thought, God, I could just tear them up, I could write all over them. I was amazed, I was on my own with them. And there was a letter.
I've not heard of you're a margin scribbler.
I know, exactly. And and there was a letter in which he talked about being on the verge of getting back together with Sylvia Plath just before she killed herself. So that was just electrifying. It was incredible. Incredible. And obviously that made a news story, as well as the piece I wrote was, I think, a cover.
What paper did he use? What was his handwriting like? What was the ink?
Can't remember what paper he used. And I can't really, unlike mine, I could read the handwriting. I think it was probably fountain pen. I can't remember.
Imagine if he'd been invited in and it was sort of...
It was entirely indecipherable.
Imagine it'd been like mine. I know. I mean, luckily I've got nothing incriminating, because nobody will ever be able to read a word I've written.
Huge thanks to Christina. The Art of Not Falling Apart is published by Atlantic Books and out now in paperback. I recommend in the strongest possible terms that absolutely everyone reads it. I've not read a better book about the emotional, troubling and sometimes toxic relationship we can have with the work we do and the impact it has on our identities. But it's also filled with jokes, love, tenderness and the wisest human insight. It's a book that will make us all better and stronger. You can find Christina on social media at QueenChristina_ on Twitter and at QueenChristinaWriter on Instagram. I'm Daisy Buchanan. Thank you so much for joining me for our frolic in the stacks. You can find me on Twitter at NotRollerGirl and on Instagram at TheDaisyBee. Say hello, suggest some guests and watch out for shelfies. Visit our show page, acast.com/booked, for more information about our guest and a list of the books they've talked about. If you have any other queries about the podcast, you can email us at whybooked@gmail.com. Your Booked is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and hosted by Acast. Please do subscribe, rate us and leave a review. It's great to hear what you think and it helps other people find the podcast. I'll see you next time and I'll leave you with some words from E. Nesbitt. There is nothing more luxurious than eating while you read, unless it be reading while you eat.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.